today on Building the Open Metaverse.
Yeah, I know, it's tricky. When something is not fully understood, it's really difficult to get together and standardize it. That's why I said, okay, geometry, I think we're there. Shading network, maybe getting there. Rigging, okay, it's getting a little painful. And now you're going into a full simulated system. So I think it will be a while before there is clearly the 90% of the definition. What is how do you define forces, collision objects, and all those things to really set the condition for a simulated system in a standardized way.
Welcome to Building the Open Metaverse, where technology experts discuss how the community is building the open metaverse together. Hosted by Patrick Cozy from Cesium and Mark Petit from Epic Games.
So hello everybody and welcome to our show Building the Open Metaverse, the podcast where technologists share their insight on how the community is building the metaverse together. Today I'm with my co-host Patrick Cozy, CEO of Cesium. Patrick, how are you?
Doing great today, Mark. Happy to be here.
Happy to be here. We have a very special guest, somebody that, if you are in the VFX industry, we've known for years. Our guest today is the father of USD, Guido Corny. Guido, welcome to the podcast. We're so happy to have you here.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me, Mark.
So let's introduce you to the people here. You've been at Pixar for 24 years before joining Adobe a year ago. And I was mentioning that when Google your name, we find voice actor. Can you tell us a little bit why you are known to the world as a voice actor?
Yeah, so this was like a story was about early 2000 when Cars was being developed in the story. And there was obviously this characters was Italian characters, big Ferrari fan, and they started looking for names. So I remember one day I was actually talking with the director, John Lasseter, about what name we could use. And I suggested, well, if you translate Io, I drive, is Io Guido. Like, it means actually guidare is to drive. So I said, Guido is not a bad name for a car. So initially it was a little bit like, okay, but coincidentally is your name. But at the end they checked and other people from Italy said, oh, Guido is a perfect name for a car. And that was the deal. On top of that, actually, I got to work on the actual character itself. I did the shading. I did the hair. There's a hair with the Italian flag. So it was kind of cool. It became my little kind of a buddy.
Pit stop, right?
Yeah. The lines were not that deep. It was a pretty simple character. Not a long time to memorize them.
Well, look, your contribution to Pixar goes way beyond the voice of Guido in Cars, I think. Can you tell us a little bit your journey there and your journey to the metaverse?
Yeah, so I started back in 1997 at Pixar, and at the time was working on Toy Story 2. So I was a TD. At the time, everybody was doing a little bit of everything. So modeling, shading, rigging, effects, whatever, because the crew were so small. So work on that movie, work on Monsters Incorporated, and then move for a number of years in R&D to really improve the shading tools. And that was the thing that I really got passionate about it, the 3D paint and look development, shading tool, et cetera. So a few years there, and then back to production when Toy Story 3 started to be in development, I applied, become like, I was a CG, the VFX supervisor for that movie, and then worked on Monsters University. Pretty much, Toy Story and Monsters are kind of like the movies I worked really actively on it. And obviously, then there's Guido on Cars. And about in 2011, in the middle actually of Monsters University, I took over the R&D group, the engineering team at Pixar, developing the Presto, the animation software, and a bunch of other stuff. And I always loved the idea to be kind of a user of the software and also like a part of the design and the development of the software. So, and sometime when I was in production, I got mad at something. I went in and just started coding a few fixes here and there. So that was the part that I enjoyed the most about being in an environment where you can do, both in a way.
Yeah, that gives you a pretty unique set of skills right there. So.
Yeah, and then again, in the beginning of the year, I started at Adobe as the director of engineering for 3D&I. I knew Sebastian from way back, and I kind of wanted to try to even look into even a broader, kind of a wider scope to software that is not just specifically for movie making, but, engineering, manufacturing, design, et cetera.
So Guido, one of the topics we were hoping to cover today is USD. And we know that you launched that when you were at Pixar. And some of my earliest encounters with USD, I've done a lot of work with Kronos and the GLTF format. And when we learned about USD getting all this traction, even outside of the movie industry, we met with some folks using USD at the Game Developer Conference. And I'll never forget the quote they said. They go, USD is not a format. It is a way of life. So we would love to hear the origin story for USD. How did you do this?
That was, again, about, more than 10 years ago now. Pixar had developed some internal, as part of the animation system, developed like a scene representation for that system itself. But it was proprietary. And at the same time, we were looking at Alembic. We had some other cache file format internally. And then we became really a mess internally at the studio itself, because we had to go through multiple APIs. You have to go like, okay, if I want to read this, I'm going to have to learn Alembic. If I have to do that, I have to learn something else. And so then the question was, well, we have something interesting here. And what do we do about it? Should we actually bring it out there and see if it can become a standard? Again, it's not just a file format, but it's a scene graph description. I think we learned a lesson with RenderMan. RenderMan never opened the RenderMan shading language. And today, RenderMan is using open shading language. The RenderMan shading language died. And what happened is, again, it was a time there was an open system. It became very similar from a kind of a power and flexibility point of view. It just took over. And so in my mind, it was all about, if we don't do something here, one day we're going to throw this thing away because something else will take over. So my pitch to, at the time, was Ed Catmull, was the president and the executives, was it actually is a competitive advantage for us to put a system out there that if it takes on and is a standard, guess what? We really like it because of the way we work. And so that was the spin. It was really about and the second aspect that drove me for that was the giving an opportunity for the engineer to do something that impacted way beyond the actual 300, 400, 500 users that we have at Pixar. And so to me, it was also sort of a retention and a sense of pride into for the production people, releasing a movie is their moment. And I wanted for our engineer, going to Seagraph and releasing something like this to be their showing to the world. Also, I felt that by going open source, the bar had to raise. Not that we had bad standards on everything, but once you got to show it to everyone, you do some extra, checks in there. So that was all those. And so we started working toward removing all the dependency from all the other file formats, Alembic, et cetera, and try to use only one system for everything at Pixar. But as we went through that, designing in a way that could be open sourced. So no crazy dependency, make sure that no copy and paste from code from somewhere and stuff like that. And that was, and then I started, I remember with, Mark was in those conversation early day, tiptoeing a bit, asking the question, what do you guys think, to the studios and to Autodesk? If we put something out that is, Alembic, GLTF, all these five formats, I see them like the JPEG of the images. And this is more like the Photoshop file. And so it's a much higher level description of the world. And the other ones are more at the leaf level. And so that was the pitch about, hey, what about going beyond the individual asset, but the aggregator of the asset, how you bring them together and how you do the overrides, that it wasn't quite, contemplated into the existing systems. And as soon as I started seeing, I actually realized that every studio had something similar. They all were doing the same stuff. And I said, maybe we just want to go first, do a good job. And if it takes off again, like I said before, we'll be happy about it because we like it.
Yeah, there was interesting anecdote is when Alembic got released, everybody realized, oh, I wish it would have been my format that got that open source stem, but Robredo and the Island guys got quicker.
Just a little fun anecdote. The original name, and we were looking at the extension for the file. Technically, we want to do something that says layered scene description, but the extension LSD, we thought it was a little too trippy. So we decided that we couldn't go in that route. So that's why the Universal came, because it feels a little maybe a little too far, but technically it was supposed to be a layered scene description. But anyway, we couldn't use that.
Yeah. Although USD is kind of has a connotation to it. So, all right. Well, so I was mentioning, and Patrick and I through this, it's probably our episode 8. We've heard about USD every single episode. I think people are enjoying, the prospect of having, interoperability, and USD is bound to play a good role. So, but we know USD is very declarative and it's kind of a static scene description. How do you see the role that you can play in the metaverse, and how can we evolve there to have more of an execution model and, you know, contribute to that exchange of simulated world, which is kind of our, I think, the overall ambition of a interop in the metaverse is, like, you know, let's trade a complete simulated world. So how do you see the roadmap to that, other milestones?
Yeah, the way we think about the metaverse is, like, there are kind of almost two layers. The first layer is, like, how do you define, you know, in a declarative way, what's there, you know, what this data, and I don't think we can go in a completely procedural. I mean, I don't know, maybe we could one day, but the idea would be you describe buildings and things and objects, and you define what's there, and that's what USD is good for. The tricky part is how we add that layer of, like, a runtime that almost takes that kind of almost like a starting condition. You know what? You have a starting condition, and then from that starting condition, you evolve. And that's actually is not necessarily has to be everything part of USD proper, in the sense that, you know, I can imagine actually to having a layer that it's above that, that does the simulation, and it changes the state of the world necessarily. But then at that point, you know, it's not necessarily a declarative world anymore, because things are driven by events and things that can happen. So actually, I wanted to avoid a bit the assumption that, oh, USD is going to be everything. You know, it's almost like because the risk is they try to be too big to make too many things and then kind of implode on its own weight. So that's why when I think about, like, a game engine, or when I think about a simulation state, I see it as, like, initial condition, I get them all in, I create the state, and I go, and I start. And then time start going in a more unpredictable way. You know, there is pieces that are predictable pre-computed, and that's why USD is okay with it for cache data, but they're more unpredictable. Now, there is definitely a conversation about it, what would look like an execution system, or actually an engine that sits on top of it, that reuse as much as possible the same schemas and definition of the what's in there. So then the transition become more natural. Like, so you know, the way you define a mesh and the way you define cameras and all of that. And how do you change those attributes now that are not driven by something that is pre-computer, but is actually driven by dependency or relationship or, like, a constraint and things like that. That's where I think the next aspect, you know, is almost like I keep thinking about when I think about the metaverse, I keep imagining there is a metaverse browser that it's actually you send links and the UST is like the HTML of it that gives you the it's not a web page, it's a web space now. And so then this browser, you know, it's a browser that on desktop looks like a browser, but in VR, it just, you get in there. And so that is more immersive, but conceptually has the same model. And so there's almost like a JavaScript or something that on top of it, that gives you that gives you that execution of it. And, you know, things that can happen based on triggering from events and things like that. And maybe at some point, again, I know maybe I'm going too far, things that have their own behavior. They don't really have to be everything to be described up front. But so UST can play a role to be, I'll give you the topology and the structure of what's in there, the way you kind of have an HTML page. I'm making a kind of a loosely thing. And then there is something on top of it that lets you play with it. Because actually, the more I think about it maybe one day we'll see a browser from Epic or from other company, is really about this idea that we will share, there won't be a single metaverse necessarily. The way we don't have a single web page to do everything. We have lots of, but it's very convenient, the idea that you jump around by maybe having a link, the way you jump around pages. And once you're in there, the browser transports you in the right way. Maybe if you have 2D element, they become a card in space, or maybe flattened on the screen, like the old HTML. But the actual scene that can be described with USD, it's actually what's driving into the browser. And again, on desktop will be flat on the screen. On VR, you're immersed. On AR, maybe it's an alpha kind of overlay. But that's kind of the model that I'm imagining is more like a transitional. And again, UST is the skeletal part that I mean, I'm not saying the UST has to be, will be, or is the best. But right now seems to be a possible player or something similar like that.
Yeah, we had Vladimir Vukicevic from Unity discussing with us the other day, and he was advocating the kind of the extension of something like GLTF with properties and even behaviors that could be potentially standardized, like something is hot. And do you think that that approach could fit well within within as a complement to what we would need USD to be as kind of the declaration of what the world is like?
Yeah, I mean there are already extensions to USD. I think Apple as well has done the one that with the behavior, and that will definitely will be the first start. I think it's maybe kind of still limited, you know, when you click you do that, but that will be definitely the first iteration will be event driven, you know, things that change into the scene. So then by user input, what I'm seeing that is even more also likely is that, you know, time goes and simulations start going, and so at that point the system, you give him property like mass and collision kind of stuff, the system then goes on its own. So it's not much event driven. I mean, there are some of it, but a lot of it may be completely, you know, again, then you need a crazy amount of compute and all sorts of other things. But I can imagine that to be, but yes, extending that the way GLTF, and so thinking about how can we create another layer on top of UST to add those behavior, maybe it's new schemas, an extension. My hope is that it's done in a coordinated way, meaning that not everyone, because, you know, Apple goes off and maybe does one, and then, you know, we have to, if somebody does something else. And so, and again, Apple started that conversation for sure, but it has to be, and I was, for example, for simulation, there was a group discussion among some of the vendors, because we want to avoid, again, this only works on the iPhone and this only works in Chrome. And that kind of, you know, stating the obvious, that's kind of what we always live with that issue.
So Guido, you just started to answer a question I actually wanted to ask. So I loved your analogy of the PSD versus the JPEG for USD and GLTF. And yeah, I wanted to ask if there's anything that you think that the GLTF world should be doing to help facilitate that collaboration.
Again, it's the same. That's why with that parallel, GLTF, I believe, unless, you know, something, you know, GLTF changes, I believe GLTF is serving a very good purpose of being a very efficient kind of a leaf node of the whole world, you know, more than an aggregating system and a try. Because the big difference with UST, that is a runtime with composition. You know, the runtime does referencing, the override, you know, all the, you know, all, it's not just like the file on disk. There's a lot more. It's the aggregation component. So for GLTF, I think it would be great to keep GLTF to be the best into that kind of a what is serving today. So when you have an asset that has to travel, you know, really fast to be presented on the web and all of that, I think it's still a valuable thing to do. Now, somebody may argue, yeah, sure, even new USD can be a leaf node. And that can be arguably. But I'm more worried about GLTF, and the same thing was kind of happening with Alembic, but it kind of didn't went all the way, start to try to become USD. Like, oh, let's add referencing, let's add override. Because really that one is not just a specification. You need to write a runtime for it. You know, and so, and that's why my hope also that some pieces of this runtime remain open. Like I was talking to NVIDIA about, hey, there is anything in the Omniverse thing that you guys have done can be open sourced, because it would be great to have some of those runtime improvements to be consistent. And because if you start having, well, that only works here and not there kind of thing, it gets tricky. So,
yeah, or I mean, Michael Kass a couple of weeks ago told us that, you know, they've done massive changes to the compositing code in USD to do performance speed up. So I agree that it would be fantastic that those can get contributed back to the community. And one conversation we had, I'm curious to have your opinion about, you know, that balance between, you know, like, you know, an open standard which lets people implement it differently and so allows for software, because you're now a software vendor, right? Allows software vendors to compete on implementation, and it's something that is like, if you know, like Kronos is managed like, you know, anybody can come. It's a relatively quote-unquote democratic process where everybody has, you know, can become a Kronos member, has a voice on how the standard will evolve, and then software vendor can compete in implementation versus the open source model where Pixar, your former employer, remains, you know, firmly at the wheel and deciding what makes and what doesn't make, but on the other hand, gives you a proper implementation. So how do you look at those two different models? And do you think that USD as an open source project can evolve into being the thing that a lot of people will depend upon?
Yeah, my hope is actually, and again, I was part of those conversation about making USD part maybe a foundation or being more open there. I really love the idea that if we continue to improve what's in that open source repository, and the reason is because it really makes sure that, because it's tricky, you know, when you implement open standards, then there's always who implements it better than other, depending if the hardware you want to push, you know, I don't know, OpenCL was a good example, and some other ones were like, yeah, standard is there, but in some platform it doesn't work and another does. And so then, you know, if I think about the on the other side from the who's experiencing it, the more is guaranteed to be like there is a certain amount. What I think would be great to keep it open source is the part that resolve what it looks like, you know, the actual ground truth of the data. So a sphere looks the same sphere. Now, if I got in front, Unreal is the most amazing system to display and interact with it, that totally should be different. What I worry about at the moment that there is something that is now start to resolve differently, you know, and now, oh, it kind of doesn't, yeah, sure, the spec is there, but it's quite not the same thing because of I took a shortcut. That's what, when I was talking to NVIDIA to make sure that if you're introducing things, then now you're needing special metadata or other things that are just specific, suddenly the resolution of the data is not consistent. You know, so where things are placed, you know, to oversimplify, right? If your sphere is here, it's supposed to be here, not here on this platform and there in that platform for whatever reason. But I agree. I think we need to, if we don't get to that openness also on the open source side, vendor will be automatically driven to start doing their own. And then and at the same time, I'm at Adobe now, and every time I say, hey, we should do this in open source, and clearly there is a tension there because, you know, they want to keep a competitive advantage. Now, when it comes to USD, the place Adobe wants to place itself is really to make the best tool to create. Like we call ourselves the Creaverse. You know, we're like right now we want to be best authoring tool, creation tool to sit on top of standards, possibly. So creating awesome USD worlds, that would be our hope. But again, I wouldn't be surprised that at some point there would be a like, oh shoot, we have this thing that only in our tools you can deal with it. But right now, I'm just trying to, I'm a firm believer.
Good. Yeah, no, it's fantastic. I think, you know, we can talk a bit more about Adobe. You guys did some recent demos, and there seems to be a very nice penchant or tendency towards proceduralism in everything you guys do. So how do you reconcile that appetite for USD and that level of procedural content, procedural materials, and all of those things?
Yeah, The idea would be to describe the procedure with USD, when you get into the billions of things, I don't even know at that point that you need an actual description for it. Like just as an example, like hair, like, you know, I was involved with making the hair system, you know, me doing the hair system. It was an irony, but I developed the system. It was used for a number of years, I think until Incredibles 2, like 10, 15 years, like a long time. But anyway, the system was all about you define some low-level detail, like a scalp, a guide, the texture, driving, all that, and then you amplify the data. Now, the way you describe the procedure was declarative. The way you actually visualize it is totally procedural. And so that is actually, and is actually at the render time. It's in the GPU. You don't even visualize it in a browser, what's in there. You're just showing in the viewport. So the way you're kind of imagining is to USD being a good place to describe a procedure, like the connected graphs, the connected nodes into a graph that describe the operation. And maybe there is some standardization of what that node does, what's name, what the parameter. That goes back to my interest in Material X as a way to standardize that. And maybe one day somebody will come up with an interesting standard to spec. How do you take an object and you line 20 of them on a surface, or like a geometry proceduralism? So USD describe it, but then that's where actually the game is played in the game engine. And that's what actually, maybe that's where you play the proprietary game. you know, how you actually visualize and you resolve all that complexity. Because USD will not be the right place to put 10 million here and put them in on disk every time. You know, if you have to, you do it, but you really you don't want to do it because the increase in complexity is way outpacing potentially in that space. I mean, NetNight is a perfect example. You're dealing with super complex, but when you go into the billions, you're not going to use standard declarative models to describe a mesh. I mean, I read some of those research. It was amazing work. And then, you know, so USD, again, at that point, is going to, we got to let it go. You know, that the scene is there. There's a bunch of procedure described. Now I'm going to resolve it, and data can explode to another level.
Yeah, the other aspect about the metaverse and the, which is the simulation aspect. I mean, you can look at the game engine as a bunch of systems. Like, you know, we have systems for very simple things like a sun sky system, which, you know, allows you to modify, you know, time of day and those kind of things. So do you see those systems, you see this approach to system we could extend just like you described for procedures, and you know, we could declare parameters and or a drivable car. I mean, you know, it's just a typical entity in the world of simulation and the world of games. You know, we have a drivable car or a Sunkai system. So do you think we could together work towards creating standards for that?
Yeah, I know. It's tricky. When something is not fully understood, it's really difficult to get together and standardize it. That's why I said, okay, geometry, I think we're there. Shading network, maybe getting there. Rigging, okay, it's getting a little painful, and now you're going into a full simulated system. So I think it will be a while before there is clearly the 90% of the definition. What is a, how do you define forces, collision objects, and all those things to really define, you know, set the condition for a simulated system in a standardized way. Again, right now we can barely say, okay, gravity and, you know, the mesh does the collision and a few other things. So maybe that will be at some point, but I wouldn't be surprised that initially there's going to be this race of, you know, figuring that out. And each one is going to say, I'm grinding it to make a step. How many times you heard an engineer, well, I'm doing this, not for this, but I want to really make it that everybody could use it. So there's always that desire. So I can imagine this to be still a few years away, because I'm not clearly see a simplification or an understanding of it to the level of like, I think we can sit down at a table and probably have a parameter space that is understood. I think it's still too, again, rigging to me is probably the next thing to look after shading. And even that one is, again, fully declarative in a way, like, you know, you just define relationship and things like that. So that one, I don't know, maybe who gets out there first and is faster and better, maybe gets an edge, but I couldn't imagine at a round table to try to come to an agreement.
And Guido, you're coming up on a common theme that we see with the podcast, which is how fast do we standardize, right? And I think it's possible to be both too soon or too late. So I think you're pretty pragmatic. And to me, a few years feels totally reasonable to do a simulated car.
Yeah, too soon burns out. Maybe even a great idea gets burned out too quickly. And also, if a company feel like constrained by a standard when they still have discovering things, I think it's not. It's not going to hold it. And you know what? And people are not going to invest on it because I don't know if it looks like the right one. I'll wait, kind of thing, right? So. I don't see people giving confidence on the, oh, we fully mastered it, here it is. We feel confident in it. I think that's the exciting part. People are hacking around. That's great. You know, to see what they come up with.
Yeah. And well, it's funny when we had Vlad on the podcast, he talked about experimenting in the open as part of the key things to drive that innovation. I very well said.
Yeah. No, that's probably the right way to go about it is to put a lot of ideas out there in public, get people build up on top of that, and, you know, refine models from there. So,
yeah, that's another thing that I try to keep thinking about it. What's the future look like, especially when I look at Blender? Not because it's specific to it, but just a general thing about an open source system that by design is going to stay there. And there is definitely that kind of a development approach versus the companies that are more like looking into, you know, keeping the software in-house, and how, when things are not fully understood, what's the best approach there, right? You know, in terms of like, you know, should we just do it in the open? Now, at the same time, obviously, that's what companies are looking for, like, you know, have that kind of a spark and we have something and come out and nobody even thought about it. Right now, we're actually, I'm pretty excited to see what's coming out. And I'm not trying to do a plug. I know it's going to look like a plug for Adobe, but I'm really excited what I'm seeing with Modeler. This is a new SDF modeling system that we are just announced and is in private beta. And it's very interesting to see. I can't wait to see what people can do in a different paradigm. And traditionally, I thought SDF was really good for the kind of organic sculpting. And I'm seeing so much hard surface going on with this tool that I'm like, wow, that's quite interesting. So be interested to see what that. So that's an area where, like, you know, you want to do something maybe in a small group of people together, and then you kind of open up and see what's the reception.
It was a very impressive demo. And I remember when I was working with the foundry, you know, that was the first attempt at doing 3D with this technology, and it was promising. They never cracked it, but looks like you guys may have cracked it.
Yeah, I was a little bit unsure. Now I see that, especially when it goes into, that's another part, right? Until you don't put your software in the hand of the artist, you can just fantasticate all the beautiful things you can do with it. And this is a clear example where it wasn't exactly clear with the hunch of it. And now when we're seeing the work, people are feeling like, okay, it's a great team. You know, it's like 8, 9 engineers, then they're making something really, I'm so super excited for that.
So Guido, if you took out your crystal ball, maybe 5 or 10 years, and, you know, given your excitement with the SDFs, design distance fields, how is content created, right? Are we scanning the world, you know, with LiDAR and photos? Or is it all procedural? Is it all done with artist tools? Tell us.
Well, I think it's I hope it's a mix, right? You know, I think there is going to be a big chunk is going to be from real world. The question will be more about how do we build tools that can take even real world things and make it unique? Because, you know, to be honest, making movies and content from scan thing is fine for Amazon selling goods, but for creativity, I don't know if it's, I don't know, what's the point of, I've seen people trying to make digital movies that they could be shot in a real live action. And what's the point of that, right? So the advances of capture and all the advances also in the AI space, when it comes also to animation and everything, I'm hoping that gives you that, you know, we used to scan pieces of cloth with a regular scanner, turn into a texture and map it onto a surface. So, but the idea would be, again, how do you merge the two? And also having tools that can deal with that data, because it's a different kind of data. It's unorganized. And so suddenly you're like, okay, now I got this kind of big mesh with things and everything. How do I turn into... So it'd be interesting to see tools that really based on that versus, you know, we went from very, very structured nerves to poly meshes and subdivs, and now even freaking dense meshes. And how do you deal with that? That's kind of my hope, that it's still a mix of the two, like procedural and novel ways to author and then scan. I see that kind of tools to make you go faster. You know, you save a bunch of time. But I know, and again, it's depend on the purpose, you know, for certain purpose as it is, but for creating new things, a new world, like, again, the metaverse that looks like real world, just with a nice illumination model or whatever, it's not that fun. You know, the has to look really different to want to go in there. So that's why some will be captured, but some will be built, hopefully.
So Guido, isn't that impressive? You know, I mean, 25 years ago when you joined Pixar, if somebody had told you that photorealism would come for free and you can spend all your money on art directing the content, it would have been a dream, right?
Yeah, and even the real time, you know, years ago when we thought, well, at some point you're going to do, you're going to create content, you know, animated content live in the moment. I was like, really? You know, they're having a session with the director where actually the decisions are made right there as you scrub timeline and you do changes. I always thought, okay, that maybe, who knows? But now I think, you know, there's so many production that are switching into kind of doing it in real time. So yeah. Now it's a matter of like the quality. And the quality, the thing about quality complexity is always also baffled me. But now maybe we're cracked it. And now we're catching, we're not always behind. It used to be always behind the curve. Complexity was making the timing not acceptable. But now, especially with the latest I've seen with UE5, I was like, we're getting there. it was really big dance. Also, because beyond a polygon per pixel, you're done. So it's going to be a whole, that's another, I think I was thinking about another big challenge, right? Especially in the metaverse. How do we make sure that, you know, you're going to see so many pixels with your eyes, whatever they are. How do you make sure that, especially because you have to define it in data, it's not like real world. How do we make sure that we don't put more than a few polygons in each visible pixel, whatever that means? Because that's going to be the biggest, one of the biggest challenge for managing complexity.
Guido, you've been very successful, and one of the things we like to ask our guests here is, you know, to some advice, because you know the metaverse opens up a lot of opportunities in many industries, but it's kind of this moment where many industries are converging to the same set of technologies. So what advice would you give to people that wants to get into, you know, and surf that wave of the metaverse personally?
Well, the first thing is to the feeling that the metaverse, whatever manifestation it is, it's actually something that you want to live in it or deal with it and experience it yourself. Like, you know, the excitement. I worry a bit that this thing is so inflated, and the idea that, you know, the Ready Player One kind of a world, I'm not sure I'm a big believer. And if somebody is, maybe that's the case. But the first advice is really to get into this world. It's going to be super fast evolving, changing, and you may develop stuff and then you got to throw it away. It's really starting from the passion, the wannabe, really building it for something better, for a beautiful, you know, future kind of thing. The way for me joining Pixar was about, I want to be part of that movie making process, whatever that takes kind of thing. So that would be, and not more about, now's the cool thing, you know, I'm just working on do some metaverse. You know, sometimes people get into the trend and go there. And instead it should be really driven, like, do we believe there is something there? For example, I believe more in AR than VR. For whatever, you know, I'm old, but I'm hoping of an augmented world where we have, you know, the idea of having avatar. It kind of, you know, I'm not a big fan of it. I would love to be able to see people. If I need to see, talk to a person, I want to talk to that person, even via video, but that person, you know, putting something there. So I'm looking more for that kind of a world that is augmented and gives you more, but it doesn't take away the everything else that is so beautiful about the real world. So anyway, the passion, I will say that. So I'm sorry, long-winded answer, but being passionate and wanted to be part of it to make it a great, make it a good, not just as a source of like cool stuff or potentially money or stuff like that.
Or following the hype cycle, which is absolutely intense right now on the metaverse. So.
Yeah, like, you know, and maybe we have to think about it. You know, remember VR? VR got this big moment, and then it went dormant, and then it comes back. Now we're like in everybody. I've been seeing people talking about the metaverse. I don't think I have any idea what that means, but they have to say, oh yeah, because we'll do some metaverse. And so now I'm trying to think about, is this the thing? And then it's going to go down dormant because we're not ready from devices. That's another thing interesting. You know, when is the day that devices will consume 3D data? Will be also very interesting by design. Like, you know, the data that you send, again, is a 3D definition of the data, not like images or how to lay them down and all that. That may be another trigger moment, because right now, devices that deal with 3D data, not quite, you know, even the VR thing, they get the video, you know, to be powerful enough, right? So that would be an interesting moment where on the wires, that's what's running on the wires.
So what do you think this first device is going to be?
The devices right now are mostly like, you know, there is some computer, but you get the images there. My thinking is like the day that those devices actually, they are onboarding, like, you know, 3D data live. And so then you get your location, your orientation, they have a 3D data there. And now it feels like crazy, like, you know, where am I going to put all that stuff? You know, but I feel like if you want to really resolve it to the maximum fidelity, you may want to go with that, you know, with the 3D. So then you can do all sort of, you know, LOD and other stuff, but the resolution is happening on the device. Right now, again, it's not quite, you know, you're putting a phone on your face right now, pretty much, right? You know, it's putting a screen kind of thing. Yeah. And then, and I don't know, maybe that's a technological, like, you know, the amount of bandwidth, you know, images are fixed amount of bandwidth. I mean, given a resolution, 3D data, it's unbound. And so maybe it will never be possible to do something like that. But that would be a moment, right? The moment that, like, you know, that's how I work. I just, that's why I was going back to that metaverse browser, that by design, the link is actually a 3D description, and the browser tried to figure out what to do based on a viewpoint and not based on, you know, that's the page.
Don't you think this could happen on the cloud and just being streaming there at the output?
Yeah, maybe that's the reason, because it's so complex. The only option is, yeah, you send your location in terms of 3D data, but it's very minimal, and you get a fixed amount, fixed bandwidth that it will be images, right? So that may be the, but conceptually, the whole pipe is built on 3D.
So Guido, we covered a lot of ground today. Is there anything we didn't cover that you were hoping to?
No, I think it was a great conversation, and I'm watching the. I'm kind of trying to figure out also how the different players, you know, they're going to try to tackle this whole thing. You know, there are because, you know, you've seen again, is it going to be again who conquest first? Is there a place for every, if actually space for everyone? And so making the assumption that there is room for everyone, so let's not worry about it. And then how do we get better and faster in that place where, again, people can experience many environments and worlds made by different companies without one try to build a closed garden to try to fend off the other? Because, you know, again, it happened in the past, right? You try to get there,
it
you
has.
Try to force it. And so maybe that's exactly the point of this podcast. The
yeah. I think we're all shaking our head in violent agreement here.
Stating the obvious.
No, and that's why Patrick and I do this podcast. I think we have to have this conversation. I think the intent is, everybody says, you know, the metaverse is bigger than any one company. We have to work together. So our contribution is to try to find a path and create, you know, not only the conversation, but hopefully we get people to motivate people to do things about it. So, on this topic, I mean, is there any organization or person that you want to give a shout out to that, you know, from your perspective would be particularly important in creating the open metaverse?
I think this is really, I mean, the players, there are not that many players right now, the big ones that really can steer the ship, right? In terms of, like, you know, there are the hardware vendors and the software side. So I may count them maybe 10 or less. At this point, you know, there are, like, you know, Epic and Unity and NVIDIA in the kind of software side. NVIDIA's kind of do a little bit of both. And then there is, like, Microsoft, you know, the usual name, nothing, you know, Facebook and all of that. So I don't see right now, and actually I like the fact that there is a bunch of players out there so again, it goes back to room for everyone. It's always tricky when you have hardware and software together. And so that's why sometimes it gets complicated, because one try to privilege the other. And so that is a little bit of a complicated marriage there. But hopefully people will realize that, again, this will not help anyone if you try to force it. Okay, this thing only works on my hardware. Because at the end, that's really what makes the big difference for the user, for the consumer. You know, it's easy to switch a link and change the whatever software is running, but not easy to have a different device every time. You know, that actually is an impediment to adoption for something like this, especially it's becoming wearable. I got to take my glasses off. I need to put the Google one. Oh, sorry, I'm going to pick the Apple now. Hold on, maybe I'll do double lens. You know, that would be insane. So by design, actually, we should think about, okay, the user is not going to change the glasses.
So do you see anybody playing a key role in potentially a shootout you want to give for the, on, you know, to create that open environment?
I mean, I see a bit, again, like I said, Adobe, I really see the value for them to really into the creation of it. And then I think in terms of the actual, who are the most equipped right now, I think, Epic and Unity are definitely, because they have the most scalable and performance software out there. And then, so those are definitely the ones. Then there is Apple, because, you know, they're going to come with the whole device. I can't really pick one. You know, that's my favorite. I keep picking one or the other. But I would say, for shaping it, I think starting from the software will be the best place to be, not from the hardware. I think about it, because the software is when you define the behavior and maybe you standardize it, and then you try to work with that. The other way around, I feel like it's going to really constrict it to like, well, that's what my battery, that's what my RAM, whatever, that's what it does. So historically, I've seen better things coming from the software side. So maybe that's the little bit of an angle there.
By the way, when we asked Michael Kass a similar question, the answer was basically you and Pixar for open sourcing USD. If, you know,
I think well, we shouldn't put too much emphasis on. I mean, I think it's a mistake to think that USD solve. I think USD will find this place as other things are building on it and really be able to leverage on it. And so I actually feel like, you know, yeah, it's right there. It's just happening there. Now, there's so much else to try to learn from it. That's what I'm saying right now with the engineers at Adobe. Some of them, they don't know USD. So you know what? I'm not going to impose USD right now. I want you to learn it and see what you can build on it. And it will take time. So that thing will go on its own pace. Yes, absolutely. If in 5 years, USD is still in one company and closed in, we have a problem. But, you know, it's not just a USD becoming really open and everybody can do, or it's more of a consortium, is going to solve. I don't know if NVIDIA is going to change to put that back into the code base. You know, I want to challenge Michael. Are you open sourcing that? Because it's slightly different.
Yeah, maybe we should have gotten both of you on the same podcast.
Yeah, and they're doing fantastic work, obviously. So I'm super excited for their, I mean, I was really pleased for their investment they made into the technology.
But I mean, on a very personal note, Guido, I had the privilege, you know, through the Autodesk CTO Council to see you, how you drove USD. It took 10 years, right? It was 10 years ago. And
yeah, 2013 was the first time I remember. It was almost 10 years, but I remember saying, hey, what do you guys think? Yeah.
Yeah, no, I remember that. But I think whatever happens, you know, I have a prediction is, you know, this work and the body of work that you led with your team at Pixar will be acknowledged as one of the, you know, one of the most significant contributions to create this open world. This is my personal prediction, Guido. I really believe that. I hear what you say about, you know, we're not done, but it's such a strong foundation. And I think I'm looking forward to the day when we recognize you as the kind of the, you know, the originator of that work.
Yeah, and I think it's more about the praise really goes to the engineers also. They really, it was really great to see them to take also the due diligence and the rigor. And production was not happy because they were going too slow when they was developing it. But they took it in a way to say, if we have to open it up, it has to be really rock solid. It's almost like, you know, when Pixar, you know, makes a movie, it has to be a good movie. And so the credits goes to them. Because I was lucky actually to see them really wanted to make such a good so anyway, so it's up to us now to continue to support and improve it even from being an outsider now, and that's why I'm excited with Adobe to see that it's definitely support and excitement to help the cause.
Yeah, no, this is great. Well, Patrick.
Indeed, it was, Guido. Thank you so much for sharing, especially all the stories. It's really exciting.
No, thank you. That was fun.
Yeah, it was fascinating. So I want to thank our everybody, our audience. We have more and more people every week listening to the podcast. And I think it's not because of Patrick or I, it's because of people like you, Guido, you know, bringing their point of view to the podcast. So I have to do what every host has to do, but remind people about subscribing, rating, raving, and renting and reviewing and talk about the podcast. Let us know who we want to see there and what we need to do differently. So Guido, thank you so much for your time. It was a great pleasure. And Patrick, we'll talk soon. Thank you, everybody.